folks, our friend Rhea Coble has recently set a world record for uphill skiing 55,000 feet in 24 hours. It's an incredible record. We wanted to get this interview out to you ASAP, so we're coming in with a special, really trial run of a live podcast that we did using an app called Fireside. We may do some more of these in the future, and if so, we'll definitely try to let you know ahead of time, probably mostly on at Travis Macy on Instagram. Awesome conversation here. Rhea is just fantastic, and I think you're going to like her stories. All right, folks, welcome to the Travis Macy Show, our first edition of a live recording through the Fireside chat platform. Hey, thanks for the applause there. Psyched to be here. Those of you in the live audience, we're new on this platform, but most of you guys know the deal. If you want to come up on stage or ask a question, you're welcome to use that react button to give feedback on the way as well. Warm welcome today to our special guest, Rhea Coble. Rhea, so glad to have you along today, and just honored to be in your presence. For those who are not familiar with Rhea, a little bit of her background: she grew up as a gymnast on the Slovenian national gymnastics team. Sometime around, I think maybe 2015, 16, 17, picked up a bug for obstacle course racing, OCR. So these are the Spartan races, the Tough Mudder races, those kind of things. And Rhea very quickly became one of the best in the world, you know, on the podium, day in and day out, winning tons of races, especially winning the longer races of 8 hours and more. Coming on top of the podium in events like the World's Toughest Mudder, which is a basically, you know, more or less 24 hours of hell, kind of running laps around an obstacle course, very often wet, muddy, wearing a wetsuit, you know, running, going over all these obstacles. I think I heard Rhea say that in one of those 24-hour races, she officially she did like 90 miles, and unofficially she actually maybe did like 120 miles or something, because of the penalty laps. So anyway, you know, just crazy sort of stuff. I got to know Rhea a little bit better at the World's Toughest Race Eco Challenge Fiji. This was a big adventure race that we did in 2019 and was televised last year on Amazon Prime in 2020. And Rhea's team, Team Canada, finished second in that. So pretty phenomenal to be second in really one of the biggest races in the world. She's done a lot in ski mountaineering, in mountain biking, in trail running, and really just all over the place. And I just, you know, Rhea, I want to tell you on a personal level, I appreciate your spirit, your positive attitude and your enthusiasm. Rhea is just, it's always contagious, whether that's, at an event in person or just through your social media and that kind of stuff. And I really appreciate, Rhea, in the last year, how you've shared just kind of your own story and your own growth through a journey back to healthy eating, you know, back to just being a well-rounded and health-focused athlete. And I think it's so cool, Rhea, that, you know, at least in my mind, kind of came together with an incredible world record this weekend, where, you know, you did something very much focused on uphill movement, but just doing that sort of, you know, as part of this journey. I'm so proud and happy for you. So yeah, Rhea, welcome to the show.
Gosh, thank you. That was like a wonderful introduction, and good thing we're not on a video, because I'm probably blushing like crazy right now. But it's an honor. It's really an honor to be here, and I'm looking forward to our chat and hopefully also catching up a little bit with you because I haven't seen you in, a year now.
Oh, sure. Well, yeah, you're of course welcome to ask me questions and stuff. So, here's a little intro, folks, on the recent world record. So, 2 weeks ago, Rhea and her ski mountaineering teammate went out and did this race. It's called the Power of Four. It's in the Aspen Snowmass area here in Colorado. And it's a long, challenging event. It's somewhere between probably 6 and 12 hours, depending on how fast you're going. And you end up climbing about 11,000 feet. So it's a big feat. And Ray, remind me the name of your teammate. And I think I saw on social media, Ray called this a date. Ray, is that the typical date? 11,000 feet of uphill skiing?
It's my preferred date. I did it with my boyfriend Roy Hobbs. So yeah, it was kind of like the last big training effort for me. And then Roy actually had to go on a work trip, so he was gone the whole week and basically flew in Friday night when I was already doing the 24-hour skiing and jumped right in and helped me out. So Audi Power of Four was a really great like last big effort. Also gear tests and basically all of it in one go, and then after that I just took it easy and relaxed for a week.
So that's most, I think, for most people, and Ray and I are kind of in this endurance sports world of being athletes and coaching other athletes, and for most people, that Power of Four is kind of a culmination and not the final tune-up workout. But Ray, I got you ready for what happened the next week, which is now just a few days ago. Tell us about it. How did you get this idea? Maybe even some of these listeners, we're talking here uphill skiing. People are going, what do you mean uphill skiing? Like skiing is a downhill thing. Tell us, how did you get this idea? Just give us the story on your world record, Rhea.
I've been doing uphill skiing or skimo for this is my third year. First year it was really just like a rookie. I did all the mistakes. It took me actually 11 hours to finish Audi Power 4 that year. Didn't really know how to ski well downhill. Wasn't really fast in the uphill. Didn't have the right gear, but I really loved it. I grew up on ski slopes actually before I even started gymnastics. My mom had me on skis. And I'd like never really lost the love for the sport. And the more I did it in Colorado, the more it just became something I was really looking forward to each winter. But this was really the first year when I focused on performance and I really finally got the right lightweight gear, which makes a big difference when you're going uphill. Every gram attached to your feet matters. And it was actually around January that my friend Ilana texted me if I want to do this crazy thing with her, and her idea was to celebrate the inauguration on January 20th by doing 6 hours of uphilling from 2 a.m. until 8 a.m. That sounded to me like a great idea, so I said yes right away. And it was so fun, and it's for the first time I tried to do like a bigger effort, on skis. And I looked at my elevation gain afterwards and I made it 14,000 feet and things definitely didn't go smoothly. So I couldn't quite figure out how to eat right in the middle of the night because it was 0 Fahrenheit. So everything was frozen and my stomach didn't really want to have any food. So it wasn't like by any means an ideal day and I felt pretty good the whole time. And so then I did a little bit of math in my head and I knew about the 24-hour record for quite a while by then. It just never seemed within reach. It stood about it before it was 50,656 feet, which comes to about 2,100 feet per hour, and that's like counting in all the downhills and transitions. And
Well,
that
this
just
is
always seemed
something
like a number I
people have
couldn't
done
reach.
this before. Ski as
Yes,
much as you
people
can
have done
uphill in
this before.
24 hours. All right. Who was the previous record holder?
Norwegian, I don't know how to pronounce her name. I'll have to look that up, but she said it in 2018, which was the same time that Killian said the men's record, which jumped from 60,000 something that Mike Foote had to 78,000 for men, which is just incredible.
78, wow. And for the listeners, Killian, for folks like Ray and I, is a household name. Killian is it's like you say, MJ is Michael Jordan. Well, Killian's Killian. Everyone knows who he is, but to the rest of the world, Killian Jornet is a little Catalonian guy who just is the best ultra runner, ski mountaineer. He's an adventurer, he runs up and down Mount Everest. Anyway, he's just kind of an incredible guy. The things he does are unbelievable, even to those of us in the community. So, yeah, sorry for interrupting, Rhea. And
Yeah, no
side question,
worries.
Rhea, do you know the previous woman who did it? Do you know? I wonder what elevation she did it at, because that's an interesting, variable. I think you did it in Aspen, and probably what you were mostly between, like, what, 8 and 10,000 feet or something.
Yeah, so the Tai-Hat goes between 8,000 and 9,600. I was considering maybe something that was a little bit closer to the Front Range because most of my friends are from Front Range, but any ski resort there is like, a couple to 3,000 feet higher than that. So ideally I'd want to go to sea level, but I kind of wanted my friends to be there more than I wanted extra oxygen. So settled on this like in between option, which was starting at 8,000 feet. And a lot of my training in the winter was done in at A Basin, which is like 9 to 12,000 feet. So I felt like I had a good base of training at higher elevations, and I should be fairly acclimated to it. Talking to my coach, he didn't seem to think it was much of an issue because realistically, I really should not be in the intensity ranges that where the lack of oxygen starts to matter a lot. For endurance effort, if you're acclimated, it shouldn't be as detrimental. So we kind of took a gamble on that, and I just hope that I could sustain it for that long. And I just looked up the name of the lady that had it before me. It was a Norwegian, Malin Haukøy. I don't know if I said that right, but I think she said it in Norway.
Cool. Well, for the listeners who are just joining, our special guest today, Rhea Koble, has recently set an up, or excuse me, a world record of uphill skiing 55,000 vertical feet in 24 hours. And we're going to get into the mindset. Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Allison. Definitely a big congrats. I mean, it really is. It's an amazing record, and I can, these kind of numbers, if you're not familiar, that may or may not mean something. I am telling you, this is a really solid record, and an athletic, and also a mental feat. And we'll get into some of the mindset stuff, because I think there's absolutely some mindset parallels and things that apply to business, to family, to other areas of life. To the live audience, you guys are welcome to request to come on stage and ask Rhea questions. And I also want to say, so to ski uphill, basically you've got skis on, you've got boots on, and you put these things on the bottom of the skis called climbing skins. And these climbing skins, they've got kind of a texture to them that's at a gradient, and they allow you to slide up the hill kind of in a mostly in a hiking sort of motion, but then when you push down, they grip into the snow. So you're kind of hiking up the hill, if you will, with skis on, and then you get to the top and you take off the skins very quickly in Rhea's case, and then you make some adjustments on your boots and bindings, and you clip in, and then you ski back down the hill, just downhill style, as if you were lift skiing at the resort. But again, this stuff is the gear is high tech. I mean, it's space age stuff. It's all carbon fiber. It looked, Rhea, did you have like those latest are they Dynafit boots? And they weigh like as much as, no joke, like a pair of slippers.
Actually, they weigh, I think, less than that. They're 400 grams per foot. They weigh nothing.
Yeah, I mean, so that's less, I mean, literally less than a pair of running shoes, probably, huh? Yeah. Okay, so anyway, so you got the idea. You said, I'm going to go out and try to ski around the clock. Did you have to purchase a ticket to Aspen, or you just show up? Did you tell anyone you're coming, to watch out with you for the grooming machines in the middle of the night, that kind of thing?
Yeah, actually, I worked with the Thai-Hack Ski Patrol for the event. I let them know ahead of time, and they were really, really nice. So at Thai-Hack, they actually do allow 24/7 uphilling. So in that sense, I didn't need a special permission to go for 24 hours. And at night, you can, utilize the whole mountain. During the day, you're kind of restricted to the uphill route, which worked for me just fine. It was a really, really good route. It's pretty consistent grades, steep and short, and it's a groomed area, so the descents are really easy because you don't have to contend with moguls and stuff. But what they also allowed us to do is they allowed us to use the warming hut overnight. So at the bottom, there's this little hut that's warm and has the bathroom and everything. And so they gave us the key. So we were actually able to set up the aid station inside, and my crew was able to, utilize the inside. There was a bathroom. And it just like made the whole thing a lot easier. And so they were super supportive of the effort, went the extra and beyond to make it a lot more pleasant for my crew and everything. So didn't
Yeah,
need a
that was
ticket,
good.
but yeah, definitely let them know what I was up to.
Yeah, nice. And this, how is the weather? So this is the same weekend that Ray is doing this in Aspen, which probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours from Denver. In Denver, there's this snowpocalypse going on, storm of the century. I mean, just all the forecasters are going nuts. People are stocking up on gasoline and groceries and ammo and who knows what else. Was it good weather in Aspen? Was it snowing a lot? Was it pretty good for you?
Oh my gosh, that almost gave me like a heart attack that week leading to it because I kind of set the date to be starting Saturday at noon and going until Sunday at noon. And then early in the week when I like confirmed and locked in the date, the forecast was still pretty mellow. And then the days went on and there was just more and more and more snow forecasted. And actually Saturday night, the blizzard was supposed to be the hardest. And at night in a blizzard with a headlamp, all the light just reflects from the snow and it's really, really hard to see where you're going. And all the snow on the ground, like it's a lot harder to ski downhill, especially once the ski resort opens and other skiers just, the snow just becomes really, really difficult. So I was freaking out all week and didn't know what to do. And around Wednesday, I actually decided to move the attempt a day early. So luckily, my crew, like a few of the people that came to crew for me, were planning on leaving Friday morning already. So I just asked them to leave a little bit earlier so I could start Friday afternoon. And I could not have been more lucky with the weather. It was, clear skies, clear night, pretty calm, a little bit of wind, which was actually tailwind, so it was helping me climb up and it was helping me break a little bit on the down, so I didn't have to make a lot of turns. And then it didn't start snowing. It was supposed to start snowing Saturday morning, but the storm held off until about 3 p.m. So it really didn't start snowing until my very last lap, and then it turned into the blizzard when I got to the top. And I ended the attempt. The 24 hours was up when I was at the top. So we like cheered and had like, a few celebratory drinks and stuff. And then we all skied down as a party ski, like my crew that came out, and we skied down in powder. So I don't think I could have
Oh, wow,
asked for
perfect.
better weather. The temperatures were between 20 and 35. Even at night, it didn't get really cold. So I was able to just add a windbreaker, and that was all I needed. It never got too warm. The skin track was always sticky. It was perfect.
Yeah. Oh, good. That's how cool that that came together. And yeah, to the listeners, 20 to 35 degrees, depending on where you live, may sound cold, but that for this the ski mountaineering sport that we do, that is quite comfortable. That's getting on the warm end. So you're not freezing cold going down, but it's also not too warm so that you're getting all sweaty on the way up. So that's great, Ray, and awesome that you were able to have that flexibility and mindset to say, okay, let's change the day of this based on the forecast. I think that's really neat, and I want to get into the mindset in a sec. Rhea. But first, tell us about the team aspect, because this is a solo world record. Again, for those who are just joining live, 55,000 feet of uphill skiing in 24 hours, doing laps on a 1,700-foot ski slope in Aspen. It's a solo record, but you, as you've alluded to, it's very much a team effort. Tell us about that, you know, in the preparation, in the you know, in the event itself. Who's on your team, and how does that play out?
Yeah, I actually had probably around 20 people come to help and crew. But even before then, I work with Dynafit pretty closely just to get the gear. So normally in a skimmer race, you have one pair of skis, you have one pair of boots, you have, a couple, 2 to 3 pairs of skins. And when you get to the top, you rip them off, you put them in your jacket, you ski down at the bottom, you put the skins back on. For this attempt, so that all takes time, like a minute here, a minute there. For this attempt in 24 hours, my stationary time was only 23 minutes, which is about 20 seconds per transition. And the reason I was able to do
Holy
that
smokes.
was because Dynafit actually gave me 2 pairs of skis. So the crew put the skins on one pair of skis at the bottom while I was skinning up with a different pair of skis. When I got to the top, for about like 2/3 of the laps, I had pacers with me. So when I ripped the skins, I didn't really have to fold them nicely. I just gave them to a pacer if a pacer was there, or I just, stuffed them in my jacket not very nicely and just skied down. So that saved a lot of time. And then when I got to the bottom, all I had to do was step out of the skis that I had, stepped into the skis that were set to go uphill with the skins already attached, grab a gel, or grab, a bowl of noodles in the middle of the night and go. So it was really the crew working, around the clock behind the scenes that got all of these parts moving and ready for me that just saved me so much time. So, it's like all the people from the community in Aspen came out. I reached out to Sean Van Horn, who attempted the record at that same place a few years before. I reached out to Mike Foote, who had the record before Killian took it, and I just got this like big like amount of knowledge that they acquired, and I used that to really refine the transitions and everything to a T. And then also in the latest hours, so many people came out that live in Aspen and just joined me for the laps. And then my friends who drove from Boulder, we were all going together for the last few laps, which helped so much mentally because I was pretty spent by then. And because of when I got to the bottom and got ready to go back up, they were already going up. I just kind of went back up. There was never a question like, should I stop or should I keep going?
Oh wow. How cool is that? And you've got that team on hand there. You've got the friends showing up. I think with these so-called solo endurance sports, you also have, your greater team as far as your coach and your family. And really, there's a lot of people putting a lot into it. And I think that's great that everyone got to celebrate on the summit with you.
Yeah, it really didn't feel like a solo thing. It felt like something I could not have done without all these other people. And I really just hope that one day I can repay everything they did for me.
Yeah. Oh well, I think you will, Ray. I think you're already doing it. And I tell you what, Ray, I mentioned this earlier, but I think one way that you're doing that is, over the last year, you've shared, kind of a very personal story about your own ups and downs and how you started with gymnastics in Slovenia and maybe the byproduct, I guess, of that was just sort of an unhealthy relationship with eating and with food. And I think by sharing that story, Ray, you're making a difference for people. I'm telling you, and that the reason I know is because I remember when Tyler Hamilton. Tyler's a former professional road cyclist who, when I was a teenager, he was kind of one of the big guys on the scene, like in the Lance era. When Tyler Hamilton wrote his book and he talked about his lifelong journey with depression, that it was so eye-opening and so empowering for me, because it was like, wow, this is the first time I've seen you know, a real role model of mine, just a professional male athlete who's out there crushing it and talking about, you know, hey, he's also got this struggle. That for me was so empowering to be like, okay, you know, hey, maybe it's okay if I also have a journey with depression, and it's okay for me to reach out and ask for help and, you know, consider therapy and medication and that kind of stuff. So anyway, just by being you, Ray, you're making a difference. I'm telling you, you're paying it forward already. Yeah, I mean it. So how about more about the mindset stuff, Ray? You know, a lot of people are curious about, like, why do you do this? What can you learn from it? You know, what about your background got you ready for this? You know, is it the years of gymnastics training? Is it the obstacle course racing, adventure racing? What do you think? You know, you can go many directions with this, but just tell us about your mindset.
Yeah, I think it's just part of my personality. I don't really have like a specific event or something that like made me want to do these things. But I guess the first time I did something, you know, that long, it was in 2017 when I did the first 24-hour obstacle course race. And I've always just kind of wondered where my limits were. And at that time, I never, you know, ran more than a marathon or anything like that. And that race was more of a kind of like a reward to myself for a successful season of racing, just something like, well, let's just try this and see how I do. And that was actually the race where I went 90 official miles, and my longest training run before then was 17 miles that year. So it was a really, really, wow. It was a massive leap. And it wasn't anything I ever thought I could achieve. I really just showed up and wanted to see how far I could go. And that's when I learned that I'm really, really good at these long things. You know, people talk about like really low and really dark moments, and I rarely have those in the long races. It tends to just, you know, like, of course it hurts, and of course there's like problems and troubleshooting, but those are the things that are really, really interesting to me. So I really actually enjoy them a lot, the long events. So they're kind of like a treat to me, something that I, you know, would do maybe like a couple times a year. But it's something that I really look forward to. And this was actually the first event where I kind of solo organized it that wasn't part of a big race. And that was actually kind of hard and a little bit scarier, because usually, you know, when you're in a race, everybody has the same conditions. Everybody is doing it at the same time. It's kind of like a more of a level playing field. With the solo effort, you know, you're going against what people have done in the past and what people will do in the future, and the conditions are never the same. So that was kind of a little scary coming into it, and I was, you know, I kind of got in the hole of like calculating paces too much in feet per hours and all of those things. And then I spoke to my sports psychologist the week before, and he kind of reminded me that what I was there to do was just to go for 24 hours and do my best, and everything else will just fall where it's going to fall. And that's really the task at hand. And I think just going and doing my best in the moment is what I really enjoy doing. So in that sense, I think that's what really draws me to these events, is just trying to find my limits. And when I was actually doing the world record attempts, I ask myself multiple times throughout it, is what I'm doing right now, is this my best in the moment? And of course I could sprint harder for like 10 seconds, but at any point in time, the effort I was putting in was the most I could put in sustainably at that moment. So it's just things like that little checks through the night. But yeah, I think I really love it. It's like, I never really like regret or like question my decisions during the event, and I'm always very happy I did it afterwards.
Yeah. Oh man, good for you, Ray. Wow, so much good stuff there. One of them, just that little check-in: am I doing my best? And making doing your best is the paramount goal. And who knows? Maybe the world record, maybe that's a byproduct of the goal. But really, that focus on doing your best all the way through, I think that's where it's at. You know, I happen to speak with a professional cyclist named Payson McKelvin last week for my podcast, and he said the same thing. You know, he said he was riding to the finish at the Leadville 100 mountain bike race, and he was battling it out for the final podium spot with the current mountain biking world champion. And he said, you know, he stopped focusing on the podium and just focused on, am I doing my best? And if he did, that would be enough. And it turned out he did beat the world champion and get the podium. But it was a byproduct. And I also like what you said, Rhea, about just keeping it simple. Because I think you're so right that with so many things in life, you know, whether it's our work or our family or even relationships, we can fall into these holes of just overanalyzing. At least I know in my own mind, you know, my mind will clench on something like a steel trap, and sometimes that's a spiral of overanalysis, and it usually isn't good. So I think the advice that you got from, you know, from your sports psychologist to just keep it simple, and your whole goal here is to just keep skiing for 24 hours. You know, wow, that is nice and simple, and all you had to do was do it. And in some ways it's hard, but it's also a very simple thing to just keep going. And I know what you're saying. I know for me, Rhea, some of my, you know, most challenging, you know, moments, whether that's with darkness or with anxiety, usually those for me happen not in the context of sports. You know, it's more of in the context of daily life. But I tell you what, man, once I'm out there on the trail, you know, doing something like this, you know, the skiing or the running or, you know, a long adventure race like the one you and I both did in Fiji, you know, it's challenging, but it's also simple. You just keep going. You just keep moving through nature. And in my opinion, I think that's what people were made to do. We were made to be outside. We were made to move. We were made to, you know, be with a small team of friends, just kind of moving through nature. What do you think about that? Are things easier for you kind of out in the woods as well?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I feel like, you know, especially in the mountains and, you know, trails, time just kind of passes. I actually made like a playlist for the 24-hour effort. I had, you know, songs and podcasts to distract me, and I didn't need to use it because I was just distracted by things that were around me. And, you know, like it might seem very repetitive and very boring when I say I went 33 times up and down that same one slope, but conditions around you change so much. So, you know, it started with the sunset, and then the stars came out and the headlamps, there were other people actually outside in the middle of the night. So, you know, the shadows from the headlamps changed. There were snow casts that were grooming, that were, you know, casting shadows when they were moving around the mountain. And then the sunrise changed everything again. And then people came and skied the slopes. And there's just so much going on around you that, to me, that's the distraction. Like, I don't really need anything else. But if you ask me to go run an hour and a half on pavement, you better think I'm going to listen to 3 podcasts in that amount of time just to make it to the finish.
I hear you. Wow. So cool. And a little reminder to the live audience here, if you'd like to come up on stage, just request to join the stage. We're open to your questions, comments, thoughts. You know, maybe you're curious about connections between the mindset for Rhea's 55,000 foot uphill skiing record and business or family. Maybe you're curious about the training or nutrition. Any question's a good one. I do see one of our audience members, Mark, has a picture with an awesome snow beard going on. So Mark, maybe this is your cup of tea if you have any questions. Rhea, another question I have down is just about your origin story. You know, I think for many of us listening, the idea of growing up in Slovenia, you know, as a gymnast is a very foreign idea. What should we know? What should you remember? What should we know? I'm also curious about Slovenia. You know, right now we've got probably the two best road cyclists in the world. happen to be from there. Are you? Do you follow road cycling? Do you know Primoz Roglic or Tadej Pogacar?
Yeah,
you know, are those guys on your radar?
I didn't used to follow it until Tour de France last year, but now I feel like just like everybody else, you know, they're from my country, and I feel like that kind of made me just follow cycling more as a sport. But yeah, really proud of that, and I feel like it maybe put Slovenia a little bit more on the map because it is really pretty country with a lot of opportunities for outdoor recreation. And you know, right now it's a little hard to travel, but once the borders open, I'm hoping that, you know, helps pick up the tourism as well.
Yeah, I tell you what, man, I've become fans of both those guys. For the listeners who aren't familiar, Tadej Pogacar, he won the Tour last summer in a very exciting fashion, basically with an incredible win on the final time trial, wherein he beat Primoz Roglic, who had been winning and just controlling the whole race. I mean, it looked like there was no chance that Primoz wasn't going to win. But then Primoz, just that guy has made a fan of me. After that tour, or after that stage, he went up and, you know, congratulated Tadej, and you could tell, you know, that he was just supporting his friend and sort of maybe in some ways his young protege. And then Primoz came back and he won the Vuelta a España, which was kind of the next big Grand Tour event. And there was also, Ray, did you by chance follow the Paris-Nice stage race just this week? We're kind of getting into the weeds here as road cycling fans, but there was more excitement with Primoz this week.
Yeah, I followed it a little bit as much as I could in between. Like, my mom just sent me updates all the time because she follows it pretty closely. So even when I don't do, she's like, oh, did you see this and that? So followed it a little bit.
Yep.
But I guess back to your question about, like, growing up in Slovenia, I feel like we're a pretty small country. We only have 2 million people, and we have quite a few really successful people in sports. And I think one of the reasons for that is, at least when I was growing up, there aren't any sports that are affiliated with schools. So sports and school is very separate. But in that sense, everybody, well, not really everybody, but anybody who's interested in sport picks what they want to do and they join a club for it. So I joined a gymnastics club when I was, you know, 6 years old, and other people join their clubs of their sport when they're a similar age. And it's kind of like an after-school activity. And it's not, it's just that one thing that you do. So, you know, your parents would take you from school, which usually ends around noon when you're a little kid, to your club, and you spend the afternoon in that club. So in a sense, you pick a sport that you want to do at a very young age, and it very quickly becomes pretty committing. So it's not like, you know, after school, you're going to try four different sports and you're going to kind of do everything a little bit for a long time. In Slovenia, you kind of pick one thing and then you do that pretty seriously. So for gymnastics, by the time I was seven, we, you know, practice 4 hours a day every day. And it's similar in other sports as well. So I feel like you really develop the skill set for that sport early on, and it's pretty serious from an early age. I don't really know how good that is for longevity. I feel like it can kind of, you know, lead to a burnout. But because of my upbringing as a gymnast, I feel like that really gave me, you know, the mental skills and the coordination and all of that that I can now apply to other sports. And I have a lifetime of exploring other sports that I love now, even though I spent like my childhood focused on that one sport. And I feel like it's similar with cycling and skiing and all of that. People just start very early and they become very focused on that one sport, which is very separate from school. I actually went to high school that was for people who were serious in sports, and we had like extra hours of PE that you didn't have to attend, and you would just go practice your own sport, and you didn't have to, you know, take exams at a certain time. It was kind of all individualized when you weren't traveling for races and stuff like that. So there's a big focus on that, and sports are very valued and kind of like this separate entity that people who are interested in it can do very seriously from a very young age.
Yeah, wow. That's 4 hours a day is a lot of training for anyone, you know, an adult professional athlete in any sport, let alone a a kid. Was the focus, was Olympics the focus in the gymnastics world?
Yeah, definitely. When, you know, when you ask little kid, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? I always said I wanted to be an Olympian. So that was always my goal and dream. And I didn't quite get there with gymnastics. But as I'm learning, I still have time.
Yeah. Well, you do. And that's, yeah, I mean, gosh, especially as a female gymnast, I mean, Olympics has got to be tough because you realistically, you probably only have one or maybe two chances, right? You know, just based on age and kind of when most gymnasts peak.
Yeah, you have basically one chance. It's around when you're 16 or 17, because then 4 years later, you know, you grow and you develop and there's, you know, little kids that come that are just better than you, at least in most cases. Of course, there's exceptions, but generally that's the case. And the way that the selections were made at the time when I was, you know, having my chance was there was one competition that mattered. So you get, you know, one jump on vault, you get a minute and a half on floor, you get a minute and a half on the beam, and probably a minute on uneven bars, and that's it. That's your chance. That's your lifetime goal condensed into under 5 minutes. So,
yeah. Oh, man.
Very few make it, but that's why it's such an elusive goal and a dream that probably every little gymnast has when they start.
So, Rhea, did you come to the U.S. first to go to Stanford?
I actually came to go to Berkeley. So I came for my undergrad in 2010.
Okay.
And then I finished my undergrad, and, you know, the kind of the standard path just seemed to be, okay, now we go to grad school. So I stayed in the Bay Area for another 3 years to do grad school. I didn't finish my PhD. I finished my master's because I realized halfway through that that's not quite the life that I wanted, and the degree that I was pursuing isn't going to enable what I really want to do in life. So I left early and focused on being an athlete, and I feel like it was one of the best decisions I've made, apart from coming to United States in the first place.
Yeah. Good for you. Wow. Well, let's go into that decision a little more, because in my book, which is called The Ultra Mindset, I write about a similar point in my, you know, I was a high school teacher. I was unsatisfied with the salary as a public school teacher, and so I got on the path to become a principal. And it's about halfway through an additional master's degree and principal licensure program when I sort of really made about the same sort of decision, like, well, I'm headed this direction, but I don't know if this is really what I want to do. And I think things maybe have the potential to be better for me and my family if I pursue more athletics and if I grow my coaching business and my writing work. And same thing, I you know, I never looked back. And one of the things I told myself at that time was, you know, if I make the jump here to being a self-employed entrepreneur, and it doesn't work for some reason, I can go back. I can find another teaching job. I can, you know, become a principal again if I want to. Those opportunities will still be there. But if I go into, you know, a career that's not a good fit for me, there's going to be a cost to that, right? What how about that, Ray? A lot of people would say, oh man, you're almost at a PhD at Stanford. How could you possibly turn away? Was that hard for you?
Yeah, it was definitely a hard decision to make, because I kind of deviated from the path that I always thought was going to be my path into something that was scary and very unstable and, you know, very not much guaranteed that I was actually going to make it. But I was talking to my PhD advisor, and really, I loved training so much at the time and racing that at the rate I was actually working at the lab, like, yes, I was, you know, 3-4 years into grad school, but I wasn't anywhere near the finish line, just because I, you know, when I had free time, instead of reading 3 extra papers, I went and ran in the mountains. So I was not making a very fast progress, and it was very clear to me where my priorities were. And so what my PhD advisor told me was, she said that, you know, I can always come back and finish later, but I have this one chance right now to be a professional athlete, and that I should really take it. And I feel like that was, you know, the last touch that I needed. So I realized that the job opportunities that the PhD would give me weren't really the jobs that would make me happy. And at the time, you know, I didn't have a house I was paying a mortgage on. I didn't have kids I had to feed. I didn't have a dog I had to feed. So it was really just the perfect opportunity when the cost of a mistake wasn't going to be fatal. So I figured I'd just take it and try and see where it leads. And it ended up being that there were a few times where I was like, oh, maybe I'll need to get a job now, you know, work for somebody in a stable income, just because things seemed to not be going so great. And then a new opportunity would come along. And I was like, okay, well, maybe I can do this for another year. So it's definitely very much living in the moment. And actually right now I'm working on my coaching business and trying to grow that as sort of like more of a stable income part. But I don't really see at the moment being able to have like a 9-to-5 job, just because, you know, training is so fun and exploring mountains is so fun and exploring my limits is so fun. And I have the privilege to be able to do that now. So I think I'm going to keep trying to make this work for as long as I can.
Yeah, good for you, Rhea. I hear you there. I think, you know, sometimes if you look at something like a career, traditionally the less risky or the stable way would be to get the PhD or become the principal, you know, stay with the 9-to-5. And I'm wondering if you know, now maybe there's a little more security in doing your own thing, you know, going your own way or investing time in, you know, something like a program like Fireside or a podcast or coaching, where you don't know where it might go, but you know, there's a chance that it can go well. And I would say, just for the listeners, you know, that the time I told you about where I, you know, happened to go self-employed, my wife and I both did that simultaneously, and we did have two little kids, you know, and a mortgage, and it really was a leap of faith. But I think it's, you know, my dad, who many of the listeners is familiar with, he's a man of many sayings, and one of his sayings is keep the faith. And it's the idea that you got to believe in yourself. And that's where it starts. You know, if you want to go big, if you want to live the life that you want, you have to start with believing in yourself, and you have to keep the faith. So we got about 5 or 6 more minutes here till the top of the, thanks Eve. I appreciate the, clapping. Till the top of the hour, we got, for those who've just joined, Rhea Coble, professional athlete, originally from Slovenia, now living in Denver, Colorado, and sort of all over the place. I think Rhea's into this this hashtag van life stuff. She's out and about traveling around, racing, adventuring. To the live audience, if you have any questions, thoughts, comments, etc., come on up here. Make a request to hop on stage, and we'd love to get you. Or you can use this this react button to submit applause. Love to get your thoughts. Again, we have Mark, who I think's into some snow sports. We got Tim, who's live on here. Looks like works with ESPN Plus, so maybe more of the traditional sports rather than this endurance stuff. Tim, I'd be curious on your thoughts on, you know, how is what you're listening to connect to the sports that you cover? And maybe in the meantime, if we're waiting for any questions, Rhea, tell us about 2021. What's the plan? You know, it kind of seems like racing's coming back. I know that's typically a big part of your calendar year, is the obstacle course races, mountain bike races, running races. What's on your agenda? Are you doing the Grand Traverse ski race coming up here soon?
I actually wanted to, but I wasn't sure how beat up I was going to be after the 24-hour ski event. I've never had boots on for more than 6 hours, so that was a big gamble. Turns out I didn't get any blisters, and I actually feel quite okay. So maybe I could have, but didn't sign up for that.
Yeah, there's a Dina Fit advertisement there. 24 hours in the boots. Gosh, I tell you, it's hard to not get a blister in that much time. Is fantastic.
Yeah, I really liked how it, but not doing anything this month competitively. The next thing I have is I'm doing Expedition Oregon Adventure Race, which is a 300-mile adventure race in May, And I'm actually doing in a reverse co-ed team. So typically, co-ed teams in adventure racing, they're required to have one person of the opposite gender. And it usually ends up being three men and one woman on a team. And this time we're actually doing three women and one guy. And we're hoping to, you know, podium or place really high just to, you know, kind of raise awareness of the fact that women can go just as fast as the guys can. So that's the next thing I'm doing. And then after that, I'm actually going to Europe in June. I'm going to try and set the fastest known time for going from the lowest to the highest point in the country. It's something I wanted to do last year, but then couldn't because of the pandemic. But what it entails is you dive 120 feet below sea level to the lowest point in the ocean, or in the sea. And then you swim to the shore, which is about 300 yards. And then you bike to the mountains, which is about 140 miles with 15,000 feet of gain. And then you climb up the tallest mountain, which is another 6,000 feet gain in about 7 miles. And no woman has done that. There's a record for guys, which I believe is between 16 and 18 hours. So just going to try that adventure in June. And then after that, probably more traditional. Awesome.
Is that Mont Blanc?
No, it's Triglav.
It's
all in Slovenia? Yes.
Okay.
So you can go in Slovenia from the lowest to the highest point in the country in under 24 hours, which I think is pretty cool. Those are the next two big things I'm training for right now. And then I'll probably do, you know, smaller races in between just for fun and to, you know, connect with the community and, yeah, just celebrate the fitness in between.
Yeah, good for you. And so are you thinking about any more OCR or not?
Yeah,
not this year?
Right now it's still pretty up in the air which races are happening and which aren't. I'm definitely still focusing on the ultra distance there. It looks like races might pick up in May, but I'm definitely doing their 24-hour world championship, which is going to be in October in Telluride. So I feel like, you know, we might actually hit the Aspen turning golden season for that, which would be pretty epic to, you know, be able to go for 24 hours just with all the gold around you. So that's definitely on my schedule. But I really learned last year to kind of be flexible with the racing and, you know, train for the sake of training and adventures. And if races happen, it's great. And if not, it's not the end of the world.
Yep. Good for you. Yeah, that's definitely a mindset that I've developed more and more that you know, in my 20s, that would have been a very unfamiliar concept. But I've, you know, maybe come along the path a little more to enjoying it and, you know, getting the wellness out of being outdoors. And I love what you're saying about the three-woman team. For those who aren't familiar, Ray is talking about a sport called adventure racing, where you're going nonstop for, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 days, running, biking, navigating, paddling, and the big race she's doing in Oregon coming up. Ray's got three women and one man on the team. And Ray, I would agree. I think you guys have as good of a shot as anyone. You know, if you look at a lot of the footage from the old Eco Challenges, for example, I think it was 98 in Argentina. There was a three-woman team with Rebecca Rush, Kathy Sasson, and Robin Benicasa, who were kind of three of the original legends from adventure racing. And they raced with Ian Adamson, and I think they ended up on the podium.
I think they did.
And so it's, listeners to my podcast will be familiar with Rebecca Rush, and there was also a team maybe 2010 or so. Four of my friends were on a team with two men and two women, and they won the world championship. So yes, absolutely, the women can totally hang tough. So Rhea, this has been awesome. Our final moment here, if anyone in the audience has any questions, comments, thoughts for Ray, you can chime in or put a reaction or join us on stage. Rhea, any closing thoughts for you or things that you want to leave us with? Or questions for me? I don't know.
When are you doing a schema race with me? I feel like you've been signed up for a few and it never, kind of the luck kind of turned around, huh?
Yeah, no, I tell you what, as far as flexibility and dealing with adversity, that's kind of been the story of my Schemo season. Really, the last few years, this Schemo, which is short for ski mountaineering, it's a very strange sport unless you live here in Colorado or maybe in Wyoming or Montana. But you're skiing uphill for most of the time and then coming back downhill. Kind of like you, Ray, I've really gotten into it in the past few years. And this year I've had to be very flexible. I showed up at one race. My son and I made the road trip, and then the day before the race, I was just skiing some downhill with my son, and he fell and got a concussion. And every the kind of thing like when I was a kid, it'd be like, oh, you hit your head, whatever. And now it's like, well, these are things to take seriously. So
Yeah.
I bailed on that race because I didn't want to, leave him the next day in case, in case there were later onset symptoms. And then shortly after that, I got COVID, and I've kind of been on the, a lot to be thankful for. I wasn't hospitalized or anything like that, but it definitely has continued to impact my heart and lungs, and I've kind of realized, similarly, I could really push it here and, maybe do a big race like the Grand Traverse in a couple weeks, but there's also a pretty significant risk that, that wouldn't be a good idea in the long run. So anyway, unfortunately, that's what it is, but I'm trying to take on the mindset of an ultra realist. This is a term that an author named Matt Fitzgerald, podcast listeners may be familiar with him as well. Matt and I talked a few weeks ago about his new book called The Comeback Quotient, and he says an ultra realist is an athlete, or really a person who, when faced with adversity, very quickly can accept the adversity and embrace it and address it. And boy, I like that idea. Again, we just happen to have this Viktor Frankl quote going across the fireside screen. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space, that's where you have the choice. That's where you have your humanity, your compassion, your ability to decide what your reaction is. Or Frankl says, in that space is our power to choose our, let's see, our response. And I think that, the ultra realist is someone who does that. So I'm trying to kind of slow down and, instead of being upset that I've had COVID and I can't do my races, well, I tell you what, Ray Coble, thanks so much. It's been awesome talking with you. Again, huge congrats on the
Thank you.
new world record, and congrats even more. Just I love your healthy and your healthy mindset to like the goal is just to do your best for 24 hours, and the outcome will be what it will.
And it
I think that's
ended
great.
up being pretty perfect. I don't think there's anything I wish I could change.
Yeah, good. Well, good deal. Well, we should definitely check in on the podcast about your Slovenia record attempt in June. That'd be an awesome thing to hear about. What a cool adventure.
Yeah.
Diving down 120 feet, biking across the country, climbing to the top of the mountain. Awesome.
I'm excited for it.
Final note here, 8 days after Rhea's incredible 55,000 foot 24-hour uphill ski, Martina Valmassoi of Italy went out and bested the number. Martina did almost 58,000 vertical feet at a ski resort in Italy. I assume the elevation there would probably be lower than Aspen, but I guess I'm not absolutely sure. Martina is an incredible athlete, big name on the Schemo circuit with a lot of experience and results over the years. So, way to go, Martina. Big feat. Sounds like she was also training for such an effort throughout the year, and just so cool to see
these days people go out and do something big. A lot of people are also watching, and records fall quickly. So great job again to Rhea and Martina.
All right, guys. Hey, thanks for listening again. Really appreciate you sharing the time with us, and we will catch you next time on the Travis Macy Show.